Scott, so where are you up to in your legal submissions?
Section 7, with the heading hearing strength 17. Starting with the heading NPS, so the National Policy Statement on Urban Development Capacity, the section in my submissions is about the council's development capacity assessments. So just to qualify that subheading, this is what paragraph 7.3, I just want to clarify a couple of things here in terms of what has happened before and Ms Hampson's evidence for this hearing. The first is in the, I refer there to the Topic 1 Derby planning decision. In that decision, the court heard evidence on only some types of business land, so that excluded industrial land. So the evidence on capacity that's confirmed in the first Topic 1 decision is about commercial office, commercial service, and retail activities. In the Topic 2 hearing, we called evidence on all business land and all residential land. So Ms Hampson provided evidence on industrial land, commercial, retail, so the types of land that fall within the definition of business in the NPS. And Dr Fairgrey called evidence on the residential capacity requirements in the NPS. They were not challenged in that hearing and accepted by the court in the first Topic 2 interim decision. Ms Hampson, in her evidence before you now, provides an update on that development capacity assessment to take into account what was notified in Stage 3. I think the key takeaway, and this has already been touched on, is that the council is meeting its requirements under the NPS as to development capacity. What it needs to do in the district plan is meet the short and medium term requirements. So in the short term, so 3 years, it must be feasible, zoned and serviced with development infrastructure. And then for the 10-year medium period, there's a slightly different obligation there as to the serviceability. It can either be serviced or funding for the development infrastructure is identified in the long-term plan. Ms Hampson's evidence is that is satisfied. We've already had reference to the long-term shortage in the Wakatipu ward. In my submission, that is not something that this district plan needs to fix. There is no requirement in the NPS that the district plan zone out for long-term capacity, nor that it identify where that capacity will be. That is the job of what is called the future development strategy, or in this district, what has been called the spatial plan.
Ms Scott, can I ask you about an issue of consistency? I understand the submission you're making about Wakatipu Basin. Effectively, that's a task for another day. But it seems to stand in some contrast to the approach that's being taken in Wanaka, where there is a concern both to identify, provide for, and lock in industrial land over that same long-term horizon that you say is not necessary under the NPS.
If I can take you to 7.9, my submission there is that this policy statement cannot determine whether various rezoning submissions should be approved, because none of them can, I guess, be successful or fail on that one in order to give effect to the NPS. So we don't have this situation here, but there are, for example, in Dunedin, there have been rezoning submissions where there is an obvious shortage in meeting development capacity requirements, and in order to give effect to the NPS, that rezoning needs to go through. We don't have that situation here.
And the council there is in the position of effectively saying, if not there, then where? Because it has to provide for it somewhere to give effect to the NPS.
That's right. So this submission, I guess, really focuses on the rezoning requests for GIZ at Gibston. There is some focus in the evidence as to the need to rezone to give effect to the NPS. In my submission, that's not required in order to give effect to the NPS. It doesn't mean it can't be rezoned, but it's not the reason to rezone it.
It doesn't mean it's not a good idea, but it doesn't mean that it's required.
Well, similarly at Wanaka, it doesn't stand in the way of making long-term provision now, if that's a sensible thing to do.
Well, if all of the general industrial that we've been looking at on the map this afternoon was stripped out, taken away, and we were no longer meeting the medium-term requirements, then that would be a problem. But I'm not suggesting that that's going to happen.
No, but neither is it a problem to provide up to the long-term requirements of industrial land in Wanaka.
No, it's not.
In this district plan.
No, it's not. So between paragraphs 7.9 and 7.10, there's a bit of a change in focus here, and this is really about the role and purpose of the GIZ. We've had a number of questions on it this morning, so I don't want to harbour it too much. But at paragraph 7.10, I just note there some submitters have filed evidence, I guess seeking to rely on the ramifications of COVID-19 as a reason to allow for a more permissive zoning framework. I just want to highlight Ms Hampson's evidence on this. Her rebuttal is that COVID-19 does not erode the basis of the higher order objectives and policies and does not mean the issues that the general industrial zone is seeking to address disappear. And also, I think it's important that, of course, this plan and when provisions come into effect essentially have what we refer to as a 10-year life, sometimes longer when we work through review processes. So it's important that the decisions that are made on the plan at the moment aren't being made for the next 6 months or 1 year, because they're going to be there for at least 10 years. Unless, of course, they were subject to a plan change in the meantime. So turning to the heading prohibited activity status. So this goes to, I guess, the focus of the general industrial zone and its purpose on industrial and service activities. And as we've already heard, some submissions seek to erode the council's general industrial zone by making it more flexible and allowing for a wider range of activities, including office, commercial and retail activities. We sort of started talking about this yesterday during some of my submissions when we addressed the Urban Development Capacity NPS. I just want to make a couple more comments on that. So one of the key objectives of the NPS is effective and efficient urban environments. So there's the efficient concept. It's one we spoke about yesterday in terms of the Bunnings decision and Judge Jackson's focus on Section 7B. Effective and efficient isn't anything new for preparing a plan. It's already part of the Section 32 tests and has been taken into account and considered by the Council through its Section 32 analysis. I just want to comment on the unique district that Queenstown is.
Queenstown Lakes.
In terms of its geographic layout, in part because of the mountains and the lakes, 97% of it is an outstanding natural landscape or feature, and that doesn't leave a lot. Quite a big part of what is left is still rural zone, RCL. So we're left with a situation where we don't have a lot of land to put into various zones and provide for certain activities within those zones. That's relevant to the council's approach and notification of a general industrial zone, which is really focused on industrial and service activities, rather than a more sort of mixed industrial zone or something closer to three parts industrial zone and certainly the business mixed use zone. I mean, by way of example, we have a industrial zone at Coneburn, at the bottom of the Remarkables. In any other district in New Zealand, I just don't think you'd expect to have that. That would probably be prized land. But in this district, that's where you have, you know, the dirty industrial zone. So there is, I think that context is relevant. We briefly spoke about the Topic 1 decision and whether industrial land was an issue, and this relates to Strategic Objective 3.3.8 and the evidence from Ms. Mann on that strategic objective. In my submission, the Topic 1 decision isn't silent on industrial land. It was a matter that was considered during the course of the hearing, and if you work through the relevant parts of the decision, and they are referenced in my footnote. Footnote 21, that should be paragraphs 159 through to 179. It's a bit broader than I thought. But in topic one, ironically, the argument that was made by some parties was that the strategic objectives needed to be relaxed so that industrial activities might be able to go into some of the commercial zones. Whereas we actually have the opposite argument being run in this hearing.
But as we know, the advocates of the Queenstown Lakes District are nothing if not flexible.
Well, I'm going to keep a consistent argument on it.
But you're from Christchurch.
My submission on that is that the court did consider whether those objectives in Chapter 3 gave effect to the NPS. And a submission I made then and I make now is that you need to consider the provisions together as a package, the PDP provisions. So just by focusing in on one objective, I don't submit that that's the right way to do it. And that is what we've seen in the Bunnings decision, and a lot of focus on 3.3.8. In the Topic 1 decision, the submission is accepted that you need to consider relevant provisions as a whole and whether they give effect to the NPS. And just to add that 3.3.8 is also not an outright prohibition as it's drafted. So in my written submissions, I have referred to Coromandel Watchdog. This is a Court of Appeal decision which is also referred to in Ms. Mann's evidence. I really just want to focus in on paragraph 715 of my submissions. So the question for the Court of Appeal that it was considering was whether prohibited activity status could only be used in a situation where the planning authority was satisfied that, within the time span of the plan, the activity in question should in no circumstances ever be allowed in the area under consideration. And the Court of Appeal answered no. So what it was saying is that there are other reasons why you can use a prohibited activity status. So I just wanted to, I guess, make clear what it was that the Court of Appeal was considering in that decision. There are a number of situations which are set out in the judgment, and they came about, I understand, through submissions that were made and conceptual ideas as to when it might be appropriate to have prohibited activity status. The decision isn't clear on which of the examples that it sets out it is okay with. It doesn't go that far. But what I have done is set out in paragraph, essentially the court says that it's some are probably good and some mightn't be, but it doesn't say which ones, because it wasn't the question before the Court of Appeal. What I have set out at 717 is two of the examples that were listed in Coromandel Watchdog as situations where prohibited activity status may be able to be imposed. I qualify that by being there a little bit of uncertainty in the Court of Appeal judgment. But the first is where the council wants to ensure that new development occurs in a coordinated and interdependent manner. And the second is where a council wishes to restrict the allocation of resources.
Ms. Scott, I understand the point you're making about Coromandel Watchdog, because the point of law was that the Environment Court should not have limited itself. One exception would have been enough.
Mm.
I have to say, I thought from my recollection was that the court approved the submissions for the whole list, but I'll have to read it again.
Mm.
But I think the interesting thing about Coromandel Watchdog and you said that Mr. Place has relied on reverse sensitivity, and I wonder whether that goes to the discussion we had earlier today about the fact that we're not talking about heavy industry in the accepted sense. This is light and slightly less light, and whether the council's case is more on allocation of resources, wishing to preserve the land resource for industrial activities that it's on stronger ground on that on that arm than it is on reverse sensitivity.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, correct.
Scott, can I ask Ben? The watchdog stuff is easy to understand when thinking about a piece of land subject to an activity that doesn't already happen on it. But I understand, and I think Ms. Hampson's evidence substantiates, that there are sites within the proposed GIZ that are already undertaking activities that are in the proposed prohibited activity list. Do we need to distinguish those sites? I mean, I don't see how the council would want to protect land that's already not being used for the purpose it wants to protect it for, which is the allocative argument you just agreed with the chair.
Yeah, it might be a question for Mr. Place, but my understanding is these zones aren't fully developed, so there's still a lot more development to go on within them. So yes, some has been developed in that way, but what the council wants to do is put a stop to any more.
No, I understand those sites that are not currently subject to the activities proposed to be prohibited. I'm trying to get my head around the logic of how one can conclude an activity that's already happening on the land is sufficiently antagonistic to whatever planning lens one might use that it should be prohibited. And the reasons you've set out, I'm not readily seeing those apply. But I might be wrong, but hence I'm asking you a question.
this, are we talking about continuing these activities? So Mr Place has
so
dealt with existing use rights.
Some of the sites in Glenda Drive that are not being used for industrial uses, they're being used for activities, office, commercial, otherwise non-ancillary to something
mm-hmm.
else, that they would be prohibited.
Mm-hmm.
Unless Ms Hampson's going to give us evidence that she's going to start seeing high-value uses revert to low-value uses, which she's shaking her head no. My question is,
yes.
What do we do with those?
Yes.
Well,
Mr Place has considered that in his evidence and has, I understand, considered options around how to provide some flexibility for them.
Yeah.
So obviously there's existing use rights, it's continuing with the consents that they have and hold. The question is if they were to go look for, a minor variation for something and how that might be dealt with. So Mr Place has considered
yeah.
that.
But legally, you're
yep.
not seeing any limitation on the council's ability to identify an activity as prohibited when that activity is already happening on the land in question?
No.
Okay. Thanks.
The issue is one of merits rather than law.
That's correct. And the next part of my written legal submissions refer to Ms Hampson's evidence on this, where she supports the approach that the council's taken.
Before you go on, I want to ask you about another consistency issue, and that is that Mr Place has taken a strong position that the existing activities can rely on their existing use rights,
mm-hmm.
and I contrast that with Ms Devlin's approach to settlement zones, in that context, she has been much more ready to recognise existing lawfully established activities and wrap a zone around them, or wrap zone provisions around them that provide for what they're currently doing. So as I say,
I think we're dealing with a very different resource. We're talking about different zone purposes. It's probably a better way to put that. We're dealing with quite different issues, I think. This is something that you'll discuss with Mr Place, but he's not opposed to allowing for some, mechanism to deal with those existing activities. It's a way of doing that which is certain and legal, and it's a little bit trickier than...
And also a way that doesn't give rise to existing environment arguments, so that you can creep out from what's currently happening and argue minimal effect.
That's exactly correct, yes.
Can I just put into that consistency mix of something that I'd like to look at is going back to Mr Roberts' evidence for the new 19B, where he's going to work on it, suggesting some more objectives and policies, but he's suggested those incompatible activities should be non-compliant. There are a couple of those which are prohibited, which are what you might call those more completely incompatible ones, mining, etc. So again, just following the chief in terms of consistency of argument across the whole plan, in terms of Mr Bates's, the sorts of activities which are suggested to be prohibited, such as offices, and Mr Roberts takes a different approach and look at those as non-compliant.
Yes, and that is deliberate. Yeah. I think there was a question either to Ms Hampson or Mr Roberts about that. I think it was to you. That is a deliberate decision. And it is also designed to achieve the objectives and policies in those respective zones.
Yes, I think that's helpful. It's useful just to be able to look across the plan and see how this sits in its totality.
Mm. Well, I think I've covered everything I have in writing there. The only matter, and I'm going to cover it now so that you don't hear from me later, is the Cadrona cattle submission. So this is just a jurisdictional issue. So the Cadrona Cattle Company are seeking a GIZ at near Luggett.
At
not.
Gibston.
At Gibston.
Victoria
just to keep my head around all these sites. So their submission seeks, I mean, the general industrial zone is obviously an urban zone, and it is located within the urban growth boundaries in terms of what the council has notified. The submission has, I guess, responded to the council's planning evidence, which raises a real issue with Chapter 4 and how we deal with urban zones and the urban growth boundary. The original submission is completely silent on this matter of urban development and on urban growth boundaries and where it should be located. And there is a, I think, a suggestion that the urban growth boundary should just be drawn around that that site. It's really just, there's a question as to whether it's consequential to a rezoning, and this partly goes to the merits, if nothing else, but we need to prepare our plan from the top, and it is Chapter 4 that tells us where we locate our urban growth boundaries. And the consent order provides consent order version of Chapter 4 provides even more detail about that. But Chapter 4 is clear that the location of new urban growth boundaries or movement of existing ones to allow for expansion of the urban environment is driven by the objectives and policies in Chapter 4 and certain criteria. So there is just an issue there as to whether it is a consequential amendment to the rezoning to also add urban growth boundaries around that site. The only thing you could really rely on in their submission is that any other additional or consequential relief to the PDP. My problem is that the relief, the submission is actually silent on urban development, except for asking for the general industrial zone. That's something we might end up looking at later, and possibly tomorrow, I think, at the rate we're going.
The stage one hearing panel in stream 13 recommended rezoning of Coneburn and putting an urban growth boundary around that. Did the, judging from all the furore about who's competing with whom, I think that's probably Scope Resources. Might be worth investigating whether Scope Resources sought an urban growth boundary in its stage one submission.
I'll look into that.
And but certainly, I think there are other precedents where land has been rezoned urban and the O&L boundary has been shifted.
We did have a submission to rely on in stage one to do that.
Yes, there was a general submission.
Yeah, I caution
whose it was.
Yes, I caution approach of applying that across the UGBs. We had a there was a general submission.
Yes, that submission
seeking
was
something
a lot
of that nature. Yeah, it certainly didn't apply to UGBs.
Yeah, I think you're right. Thank you for that.
So that's all. What I will do now is pass over to Miss Hampson. So she has, and this might assist in terms of, I mean, what are the right questions. She has prepared her evidence. She's got a general section, and near the end, she just deals with all of the rezonings. So we'll just park the rezonings for now.
So we've already covered paragraph 8 in my summary of evidence, so I'm just going to scoot through paragraphs 1 to 7. My evidence discusses the latest update of the BDCA for Queenstown Lakes District. My evidence then focuses on the general industrial zone and the economic costs and benefits of the proposed zoning. I pay particular attention to submissions on the notified GIZ in Wanaka and also the proposals for GIZ in Victoria Flats. I comment briefly on submissions in Luggett, where I support zoning that would enable the relocation of an existing supply, trade supply and service business, and Arrowtown, where I do not support a change to business mixed use zone due to the adverse effects of this is likely to have on existing industrial and service activities which dominate that zone area. My rebuttal evidence on the Universal Development Limited submission in Hawea covers the request for general industrial zone, local shopping centre zone and residential zoning. The BDCA, like its housing counterpart, the HDCA, is an assessment under the NPS UDC designed to inform council whether their zoning provisions are providing sufficient commercially feasible capacity to meet long-term demand for industrial, commercial and retail development. It is a high-level tool based on a mix of data and assumptions that should be used in conjunction with other local-level data to help inform decision-making and responsive planning by council. Permissive operative industrial zones have not been successful in securing capacity for industrial and service growth due to competition for land by higher value commercial, retail and other activities. I support the objectives, policies and rules of the general industrial zone as modified by Mr. Place in response to submissions. And from an economic perspective, I consider that they will be effective in achieving the strategic objectives in chapters 3 and 4 of the PDP and ensuring that industrial and service activities can operate sustainably in QLD. The general industrial zone complements other operative and proposed urban zones, and the locations of general industrial zones supported in my evidence will lead to efficient and positive outcomes for the industrial and wider economy. Overall, my research has shown that the industrial economy accounts for a large number of businesses and employment in the district. It is not appropriate to compare QLD's industrial economy with other districts. The mix and size of businesses is shaped by the nature of demand in this district and the district's location and relationship with other economies. These drivers are not expected to materially change in the future, and what we see today is a sound basis for future planning and continued strong growth relative to other sectors is projected. And relevant to all rezoning submissions, in my view, a surplus of capacity reported in the BDCA on its own is not justification to take capacity from one land use and give it to another. Nor should a reported surplus of capacity prevent council from zoning additional capacity where there are strategic benefits in doing so, and the additional capacity materially enhances the functionality of urban areas and settlements in the short to medium term. Each site needs to be considered in the local and wider context. While a reported shortfall of industrial capacity in the BDCA in Queenstown does need to be addressed by council, it is important that any decision is approached strategically in terms of long-term urban form outcomes. The BDCA is a key input to the future development strategy and spatial plan, which is intended to take a strategic and long-term approach to the future growth of the district. Council need only zone sufficient capacity to meet demand over the medium term, so the next 10 years, and identify long-term growth areas in the FDS, i.e. to meet the demand in the 10 to 30 year time period.
Thank you, Ms. Hampson. Commissioner Hill.
Can I start? I think, because we're talking about the economic evidence here, not going into real zoning, just keeping it at a broad scale. So I think I understand your whole premise. In terms of the general industrial zone, what you're saying is what's been zoned and provided for is sufficient in terms of the national policy statement direction. And also that it needs to be protected, and I use that word small p, in terms of the types of activities that go into it, i.e. not to let it get watered down by office and retail, etc. And on that basis, it's your view that that is an efficient allocation of that resource. Is that's basically the proposition?
Yes, that's true. And I also think it's efficient in a zoning to have an industrial zone that does that relative to the full suite of zones in the PDP.
Some economists would, and I go to your paragraph 4, the permissive operative industrial zone has been taken over by those higher value commercial and activities, and a number of economists that I know would say that's actually a very efficient allocation because that's higher and best use. What do you say to that?
I think that was also partly what was in the Bunnings decision in terms of, you know, surely efficiency is the highest and best use for the land. My view is that that's not really the intention of the RMA, and that zoning is an important part of allocating resources, and that's a necessary step to prevent the market from taking a free approach.
So thank you for that. So it's an interesting proposition. So that's your economic view, and of course that's supported by the planning evidence that says from an economic perspective you need to intervene into the market and the planning situation in the planning world to strictly control, one, where the zone is and therefore what activities go into it.
Yeah, although allowing some flexibility, not too...
Exactly. Mm. So what's your view, I mean, in terms of the NPS, it talks about, you know, sufficient... providing sufficient in the short and the medium term. What's the difficulty, I say, with oversupply? What would be the problem of creating a lot more? And I go to some of the rezoning requests that come later. From an economic point of view, what's the problem with oversupply?
It depends on the sort of zone that you're oversupplying. So you can...
Say GIS, GIZ, sorry, I'm talking about specifically.
I'm not so concerned about oversupplying general industrial zone because it grows, it provides good certainty to the market. It's not a zone that fills up as fast as some zones, but it is the one that is hardest to find a place for, particularly in a district like this. So I do support places in Wanaka where they have provided sufficient zoning because there was a strategic opportunity to do that down Ballantyne Road. And I don't think there's any harm in oversupplying in that context, which is very different from perhaps oversupplying too much retail land, because then you end up dispersing activity and pepper potting growth in lots of locations.
You're totally right. In terms of that question, talking about the two Gibson Valley proposed rezonings, from an economic perspective, put aside the landscape and the trap and all the other reasons why council are not recommending part of it, what would be the economic issue in terms of oversupply of those sites? I know there are connection issues in there, and there might be some efficiencies in terms of grouping.
Yeah, I think that it comes down to what is the most functional urban environment. And I think there are economic consequences to not having a consolidated urban environment. And so there would be a cost to the customers and other businesses that interface with businesses that are located so far down that, you know, remotely. I think there are potentially some issues in terms of the commercial feasibility of that for certain types of businesses that rely on an interface with customers. So there's some sort of micro-level inefficiencies with a location like that. I've also suggested that there are other aspects that would make it a commercially feasible location, but I don't think it makes a good strategic location in terms of urban planning.
What I don't want to talk about specific zoning, so you have a different approach to the Upper Clutha activity, where you would support the zoning, and the officers are recommending a different overlay.
Yes.
How does that sit with what you just said about the other two?
The case in Luggett with Upper Clutha Transport is allowing an existing industrial and service business and trade supply to retain its location in Luggett. And so that's not about creating... there's no net change in terms of capacity, really. It's just shifting to a location that is more sustainable for them going forward.
Thank you. Mr. McLeod.
Can I ask you a couple of questions about in your evidence in chief, you discuss employment growth being strong. I know we've discussed COVID and the COVID effect. In your moving forward, what sort of hiatus are we looking at in terms of employment growth being strong? Is that a V-shape, is that a W-shape, recovery from that? And then what time frames are you
in terms of an effect of COVID on a projection of growth?
Yes.
I haven't been brave enough to guess what that recovery might look like. There has been other economic evidence provided across the various topics that I have agreed with in terms of some of the past economic crises that we have faced have shown around a 3-year recovery period. And I think that is also shown in terms of the industrial economy and the employment recovery after the GFC, which was the most recent one. And the growth has actually accelerated since that point. Whether COVID is going to impact extensively on the sorts of businesses in the industrial economy, yes, there's a construction focus. That construction is strongly linked to housing development as opposed to and commercial retail. Not a lot of hotel construction really in the recent period. I guess I'm just not really willing to speculate.
What I'm driving at is that the Queensland Lakes District is quite unique in that it is a tourism business, and our esteemed mayor calls it the truck and trailer. The truck is the business that pulls the trailer, which is the building and construction industry. So we're potentially looking at a long-term impacts on tourism, which impacts on construction. Are we, you know, in terms of a skewed look at the world, is this, COVID is a tunnel, we'll get through it, we'll come out, but will the world be the same? And what I'm driving at is that those, yes, there's a reason to provide, but potentially there is a capacity. So therefore, aren't we in the short and the medium term? So some of the submitters have been asking for change of use, et cetera, et cetera. I'm just trying to get a handle on your understanding of those changes. And yes, it's a COVID effect, but does it have a skew on how we are moving forward? That's sort of what I'm asking for you.
Yeah, no, I think we need to continue planning for industrial growth the way we have in the past. I think there will be a recovery. Queenstown's attraction and its attributes and characteristics within New Zealand are unchanged, and that will continue to attract migration within New Zealand. It will continue to attract domestic tourism, and eventually it will continue to attract international tourism when that can come back. I don't think that a short-term slowdown of growth is a good and sound basis for moving to more permissive zoning across extensive areas of our urban environment.
Or even restricted. But the one other question, turning to 8.9, you discuss the ownership of industrial GIZ, hang on, I forget this right, 5.26, I apologize, I've got that wrong, we're discussing ownership of the commercial land capacity in Wanaka, 80%, more than half of that potential is owned by one person. Special zone. Is that a concern from an economic perspective?
The NPS would certainly encourage competition, and I think there is competition, sufficient competition in the zoning that's been notified. I think if the landowner had shown reluctance to do anything with their land, then that might be more of a concern. Certainly, Valentine Ridge has proceeded and sold out. If the land had sat there bare, I'd be more concerned. But the tricky thing with the general industrial zone is that creating lots more locations for general industrial zone just to satisfy a policy for competition among landowners is perhaps, I think, little weight should be given to that, because it doesn't make sense to distribute the zoning, and we need to consolidate it here. And if the consequence of that is that we have limited ownership at the moment, and there's no reason why that that may not stay the same over time. I'm not concerned about that in Wanaka.
Okay. And turning now to your rebuttal and its discussion with regard to universal and site.
We're holding the rezoning application, so
damn,
hold their thoughts.
I'll hold that thought on
okay.
The advice of the Honourable Chair. And just one final question, and you may not be obviously a landscape expert, but in terms of the shift of the Upper Clutha Yard in Lugget, or as some people call it, Lugate. Believe that question, it was entirely not your field, so I'll leave that alone.
Right.
Thank you.
Ms. Hampson, can I return to the point you made when discussing with Commissioner McLeod about a new light will dawn? The district will recover at some point. I'm going to ask Mr. Colgrave this question, but he presents a bar graph that shows in the GFC, like it's hard to tell, but there might have been a 5 or 10% drop in the number of tourists, and other downturns produce a static. I think wouldn't be a strain to think that 2020 might be 30%, and 2021 might not be a lot better. So are we talking a completely different scale that the district's never seen before?
Yes, I'd agree that COVID is probably the biggest crisis we've faced from an economic point of view.
And I can understand your reluctance to predict. Can I put it round the other way? Should we beware extrapolating past trends to this unique situation? We are really in unknown territory.
No, I don't think so, because the drivers of the industrial economy here relate to construction of housing and population growth, and natural increase of population of the resident population will continue regardless of COVID. I think if the industrial economy here is centred on construction and there will still be some form of growth, then the nature of the activities in this district aren't significantly going to change. There's been some suggestion that maybe this could become a real manufacturing district. I think that's optimistic, given that we don't have a port close by and we don't have excellent transport network connections to other major centres. So I think a business as usual approach is where we're heading. And yes, it's realistic to think there will be a slowdown for a period of time, but if we're going to return to anything, it's going to be returning to what I think we have now.
So, paraphrasing what I understand you've just said, the world will not look different, but it may just take a while before it returns to what it used to look like, and we don't know how long that will be.
That's a good analogy, yes.
Looking at the discussion in your section, at the end of section 10, about potential approaches to trade suppliers, and you test various metrics to manage trade suppliers, I was wondering myself about testing it by reference to how the trade supplier positions their business, who they market to. I think about being driven to distraction by TV ads telling me about Bunnings price guarantee, and I don't think that they're marketing to trade buyers on nationwide TV in the middle of the news.
Yeah, I think my evidence picks up on that. There is a broad spectrum of trade suppliers, and there are some who are primarily, you know, they rely on a retail component for their business, and yes, they do trade as well. And then there are others which are purely trade, and you can't buy there. You can't buy there if you're the general public. There's so much of a broad spectrum that I couldn't find a single a metric really that would be consistently applied. I think Mr. Place has come up with some provisions to try and avoid perhaps the Bunnings type outcome, which are really a destination for the public in terms of shopping. That they would be less appropriate in the general industrial zone and focus more on those wholesale ones that have a trade focus, because then they're more likely to support industrial and service businesses in a co-located environment.
So, as I say, it obviously not something that you can put hard numbers on, but looking at what their business, what a business model is, and who they're marketing to, is that a potential way forward? No.
Yes, although different size businesses will have different marketing budgets, and some will be more obvious than others. But you're right, that is an indication that they are targeting the general public, as opposed to a wholesaler that might choose to advertise through a trade magazine or, through some other sector-related communication. I'm not sure if you could build planning rules around that, though.
Indeed. But going to your rebuttal, to ask you about your figure 2 on page 11. So the two questions. Is that conceptual or is it based on real data?
That's a conceptual diagram.
Whose concept is it? Yours or someone else's?
No, it's not mine. No, I think that's a sort of a general... I couldn't tell you the source, sorry. I think that's a fairly common diagram you'd learn in Economics 101.
Commissioner Hill hides his light under a bushel, but he has an economics background, so he can tell me about it.
A long time ago, Mr. Robinson.
And that's universal. So we won't go there at the moment. Commissioner Dawson.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Harris. I know I come to us from a Christchurch focus, so I could be off track here, so tell me. 7.6 and 7.7 of your evidence, you touch on the matter of concentrating activities in particular locations where benefits can be maximised. And you're talking about the non-industrial activities that might go into the general industrial zone if it was more permissive.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I was a bit surprised that both yours and Mr. Place's evidence didn't focus more on what are very strong objectives and policies in the strategic chapter about town centres, the Queenstown and Wanaka town centres, even the Frankton commercial area as a whole. And those sort of the strength of those objectives in relation to the planning for the location of offices and retail,
mm-hmm.
not for the necessarily for the sake of protecting industrial and service activities, but for the sake of those centres themselves and their strength and viability. So is there anything, is that a key issue for this district in terms of where where commercial, office, retail locate, or is that a bit of a side issue to the importance of protecting industrial and service activities from competition from those activities?
No, I think you're exactly right, and I think that's an issue for every district, is the supporting the intended role of specific zones, and that's where we get the most efficient urban, the functioning of the urban environment, where a town centre is not undermined by dispersed retail across multiple zones, where an office park or an office zone doesn't have to compete with multiple other zones. And I think I have covered both of those. There is the benefit to the businesses, the industrial and service businesses within the general industrial zone, but then there is the wider benefit to the integrity, if you like, of all the other zones in the district plan. And that's why I think that strict approach is appropriate, because the district plan has done well, I think, to provide zones that allow everything to have a home and choice. So on the one hand, we're enabling a large strip of business mixed-use zone on the other side of Ballantyne Road in three parts, and therefore I think that's complementary to a general industrial zone on the other side that would direct or redirect those activities into that zone so it can develop efficiently.
So in weighing up the permissiveness of the general industrial zone for those other activities, the non-industrial and service activities, you're saying we should put emphasis on the strategic objectives and policies that
yes.
look to consolidate those activities in other zones,
yes.
in particular in the ones I'm looking at, the town centre and the key commercial areas,
yes.
for the sake of their integrity and functioning and efficiency.
Absolutely.
Okay,
yep.
Thank you. So I just have one other question. In 11.11, and here I'm talking about scale of ancillary office and retail that might be permitted. And here you talk, and you do some analysis about different examples and different percentages, and you do end up saying that based on the permitted lot size, the total building envelope attributable to ancillary activities does appear modest. And I know, I think there is evidence saying, I think it might be Mr. Place's evidence saying we shouldn't go rushing off and looking at other zones or other districts because everyone's zones are different. But when you do that, you do find that a 50 square metre and then 100 as RDA and beyond that potentially prohibited is modest. I mean, there are many that talk about 200 or 250 or maybe 100 is permitted and then another step. So my question is, because then you go on and look at the alternative, which is to use a percentage, and you say, well, that can get huge. Suddenly it's sort of out of control, and you're potentially with a large site having a large area. But many district plans use an either-or approach, with the lesser being, you know, like you could say, I don't know, 200 250 or 100, whatever you have, or a certain percentage, whichever is the lesser. So it doesn't allow it to jump out of control.
Mm.
And had you looked at that option as a way of putting a lid on the out of control percentage versus, but also giving a bit more flexibility from that modest permissive GFA?
I didn't consider that, and I guess that seems like a reasonable approach. If because the percentage was, as you say, the significance relative to the building envelope was starting to compete with perhaps other zones. I think if you could find a way to blend the two together, and that's been used elsewhere, then yes, that seems appropriate.
Okay. Well, I'll ask Mr. Mason about that as well. Thank you. That's all my questions. Thank you.
Can I have one follow-up? I thought of something else. In terms of efficiency, some of the submitters are putting to us the fact that they have consented buildings that are designed for general office or retail, and that it would be very difficult, if not impossible, and certainly not economically feasible, to convert them to industrial use. Is that an issue of efficiency that we need to consider?
I've addressed that in my evidence in terms of the opportunity costs to those owners of those buildings in those zones. I don't believe there's any opportunity cost in terms of existing use rights, and if they've got an approved consent, there is every expectation that those landlords or building owners can continue to find tenants that suit their building. I think the opportunity cost arises, and I think it's been discussed elsewhere, if that business wanted to expand or vary that building, which the consent is tied to, and in which case then they might find some difficulties. But that's not every business and it's not every building, so I think that chance of that opportunity cost is fairly minor.
I think the particular issue that they're raising is that they're not consented for the use, they've only consented the building. So they've effectively got an empty building that they can't consent for what it was designed for.
I understood that land use consents were tied to the land and that stays with the land. But are you saying they've only got a building consent?
Yes.
And therefore a non-complying activity?
Or a prohibited activity.
Already?
Yes.
It's already prohibited or non?
Under the proposed rules.
Yeah, I think that might be more of a question for Mr. Place.
Oh, well, he can think about it in the meantime. Commissioner Munro.
Thanks.
Commissioner Smith. That's us.
Excellent. Thank you. So next is Mr. Matthew. He's been waiting all day, patiently.
Thank you.
Thank you. Looks like the place has been fishing it out. Thank you.
So Mr. Matthew's presentation is a little bit more straightforward because it's largely planning matters. So he's filed Section 42A report and one rebuttal statement dated 12th June. You now have his summary. I'll ask him to read. Or do you have any corrections to make?
Sorry, I thought I had a copy in my bundle, but I don't.
You had your chance.
So I'll ask him to read through his summary.
My evidence assesses and makes recommendations on the rezoning submissions for 101 Valentine Road. I've grouped these submissions into three main topics, two of which are summarised in the statement, with specific submissions addressed in each topic grouping. Overall, my recommendation is that a notified active sports and recreational zoning for the site should be retained. Topic 1, allowing for community activities. Morgan Withington. This submission seeks that the active sports and recreational zone chapter be modified to permit community activities as defined in Chapter 2 definitions on the site. Community activities encompass a broad range of activities, including commercial activities. The open space zones, including the active sports and recreational zone, allow for compatible community activities to locate within the same zone. It achieves this through different activity statuses for particular community activities depending on the purpose of and policy direction of the relevant open space and recreational zone. The purpose of the active sport and recreational zone clarifies a focus envelope of activities within that zone, but also allows, albeit through a non-complying consenting pathway, for activities not allocated a specific rule or not necessarily anticipated to be considered on a case-by-case basis. The relief sought in turn does not distinguish between different kinds of community activities. I considered that a notified active sports or recreational zone is more appropriate than permitting all community activities to establish within the zone, within the active sport or recreational zone, and that it could result in incompatible activities locating at the site, which would compromise the purpose of the zone. I also considered that a site does not have any known characteristics over other sites within this active sports or recreational zone that warrants bespoke rules or special treatment, and I do not consider it necessary to individually list all community activities covered by the definition. Topic 2, active sports or recreational zone or industrial zone. Tasek Rice et al. This submission generally seeks to reduce the extent of the notified ASRZ on the site, while also seeking that part of the site be rezoned to general industrial zone. The main reason for the relief set out by the submitter includes the need to consolidate sporting facilities with the existing recreational centre, that the site is one of a few larger sites remaining that is suitable for industrial activities anticipated by the notified general industrial zone, and that the whole site is not required for sport fields. I consider the reasons to be valid. However, I use the same reasons to argue that a notified active sport and recreational zone should remain. Planning to meet demand for sport fields up to 2028 will not allow for the consolidation of sporting facilities and various benefits associated in the long term. There is also there's a need for other sporting facilities and a need for sport facilities to co-locate as part of a larger multicultural hub. The site offers an opportunity to plan and zone for a large consolidated area of open space close to a key growth area of Wanaka, and the active sports and recreational zone does not only provide for sport fields but also other sport facilities, certain community activities, open space and recreational uses, with a functional need to locate in close proximity to residential areas and public transport. The site could offer cultural and economic value by hosting larger sporting events or even non-sporting festivals, particularly given the lack of other larger areas of undeveloped land available within the urban growth boundary. Overall, I consider the site is of a size and in an ideal location to serve as a regional multi-code hub for community and recreational uses to co-locate, and that the notified active sports and recreational zoning therefore is appropriate. I also consider that the question to be answered is what is the most appropriate zone for the site, not whether the site should be rezoned in part to deal with lost capacity through separate rezoning submissions. Nevertheless, Council's evidence, Ms. Hansen's economic evidence, demonstrate that there is sufficient general industrial zone capacity up to 2048. Given that half this site would only meet medium-term demand for sport fields, not even considering the other uses, up to 2028, the likely long-term need for the site to be zoned active sport and recreation is clearly greater. This, combined with the benefits of co-location, the ideal location of the site to serve the nearby residents, and the potential to serve the larger district, overweights any argument for considering other uses for the site.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Matthew. Could I ask you an initial question about the strip of land connecting 101 Valentine Road to Riverbank Road.
Sure.
First of all, how wide is it?
Can't remember exactly. I think it's about 4 meters. I remember looking at it and I found it that it was a bit too narrow to serve as a road, but I thought it would be good for pedestrian access. Can't remember exactly what the width was at that.
So, too narrow for a road, but 4 meters.
Yeah, I think so.
And in your 611, am I correct in inferring you're suggesting, in your view, this is a minor change within clause 16? Rezoning that 4 metre strip.
Yes, that's correct. I think the section 32 does talk about the whole site, which includes the strip. So I think it's just a mapping error where they didn't map that in the same colour.
And it's the inference I should draw that there is no submission that would support that zone change.
There is a submission in the on the that site for the general industrial that seeks to extend the general industrial to the other side of that strip, and
know,
that's also covered.
Is there any that seeks to rezone it to open space?
I don't think so, no.
Because it's the submission of Willow Ridge that you're talking about that I'm interested in. one of the tests of whether something is a minor change is that anyone is prejudiced. And that, given Willow Ridge's ambition to develop that for industrial use, on the face of it, if it were rezoned, that would create a setback over land that's not currently the subject of a setback. You thought about that in terms of whether you can satisfy the Clause 16 test? Because I'm sure we're going to hear about it from Willowridge.
Yeah. No, I haven't given more thought in terms of the second Clause 16. I did look at, you're right, it does cause greater setbacks, and I think that's one of the reasons I looked at it, is because I thought that I think if it's industrial on both sides, you can build almost up to the boundary of that pedestrian access.
Now, I don't expect you to give me an answer right here and now, but I think that in anticipation that Willow Ridge are going to submit to us that that is not a minor change, I think you need to tell us, probably in the council's reply, whether you maintain that view, and if so, why. Commissioner McLeod.
Just turning to the submission by Ms. Wellington and the Land for Community Activities. In your evidence, Chief, you do list, I won't list it, it's on 4.2. The unappealing definition of community activities encompasses a broad range of activities, and given that that sort of fits within, or could be seen to fit within any other, where would be your justification, best guess, in terms of a planning outcome, if that were to be located on that piece of land?
I guess the difficulty is to try and figure out what exactly they are proposing, because the scale could vary significantly from a large-scale maternity ward with massive birthing units.
Okay.
So you'll have to consider surrounding land uses, which is probably, I guess if it introduces a sensitive receptor, it's probably better to locate it closer to the residential, maybe the northeastern corner or the northwestern corner of the site. So closer towards, away from the industrial land and the sport fields potentially. Yeah, I haven't really looked into that.
No, it's fine. It's not in the centre, obviously.
No.
And one other, just a bit of it has been discussed, but it's the relationship between the use and your opinion of the relationship between the use as ESRZ and the general industrial and mixed use, business mixed use. How do you, you've got no issues, or do you have any issues in your opinion about the interface?
Between the active sports and general industrial and business mixed use. Are you talking about between the ODP, the Ballantyne business mixed use, or and the industrial, or are you talking about the rezoning to active sports?
Existing environment and PDP rezone.
I think in terms of the active sports and recreational, it is, I would say, a better fit next to industrial compared to, say, residential or mixed use next to industrial. So in my opinion, it kind of creates like a buffer, putting the notified active sports and recreational there.
And you touched on half the site and its availability to, and apologies, you may have read it in your original evidence, but just is there an understanding of how far out this will provide facilities for it? Like sporting facilities, sporting fields, large-scale sporting fields for it?
There is a winter sport availability study that's in my appendix in the 42A, which talks about, and it's also in the some of the submitted evidence, about 8.5 hectares would meet the demand up till 2028. But in saying that, that is only looking at rugby and those sort of things, that sport, it's only looking at those users for the site. Yeah.
That's fine. Thank you. That's
everything. One follow-up that I've thought of since, I think. Do you think that the maternity unit could potentially be consented on this land if it remained as proposed? Open sport and recreation?
Yes.
No doubt there'd be any number of issues that would have to be addressed, but in principle, yes.
Yeah.
Commissioner Hill.
Just one question for me, and come back to the community activities, and I understand why you're recommending that it doesn't go here. Mr. Wetherington, has there been any discussion with him? I've skimmed all the submissions, but it was a long time ago now. I mean, do you think he understood what he was asking for?
Or she?
We haven't been in direct discussion. That was one of my difficulties to try and address what they're asking for in relief. Yes.
Okay. No,
it's fine. Commissioner Dawson.
Again, on the community activities. So just so I'm clear, in these open space and recreation zones, a number of community activities are singled out, like community centres and halls and daycare centres and libraries and art galleries.
Yes.
And they're given certain activity statuses in the different types of zones.
Yes.
Like, what have I got here? Community centres and halls as a discretionary activity in this active sports zone, for example.
Yeah.
But then any other community activities that don't fall into one of the singled out provisions would have to fall into the any activity not listed provision.
Non-complying,
which
yes.
Is non-complying in across all of the open space zones. Yes, it is. Yeah.
Yes, it's different open space zones have different listed and different activity
yeah,
statuses.
But the activity not listed as non-compliant.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. Now, in 3.3 of your rebuttal, you refer to a policy which you think is an enabling policy for community activities generally. Would you like to read that out to us?
3.3?
No, 3.
The policy?
38, I could read it out to you if you like, but
yep.
You could read it out.
Where are you find it? Going from?
3.3 of his rebuttal. You refer to a policy, 38511, and it's under an objective, 38511. But the policy is the one you refer to. Rebuttal brief, the very short one, 12th of June. So is it Greaves or Graves?
Greaves.
Greaves for Morgan Weather Leamington.
So you want me to read the policy?
Well, yes, because it's interesting. Because you just read it and then I'll ask you. Because you don't actually quote it in your rebuttal, you just say what it sort of says.
So it says active sports and recreational activities are provided for in appropriate locations while managing adverse effects on the surrounding areas and communities.
So that's the objective?
Yes, so
now
I think.
The policy that you refer to is under there?
Yes, so provide for indoor and outdoor organised sports, active recreation, recreational facilities, community activities, accessory activities and associated buildings and structures.
So this policy applies to all of this is just in the active sport. So this is a specific policy for the active sport and recreation zone.
Yes.
So do you think that that policy, which basically says to provide for community activities, that's all it says, do you think that that is adequately reflected by non-complying activity status for most community activities?
I think you need to read the objectives and policies in the context of the zone purpose, which clearly kind of sets out what the intention of that specific zone is, and that flows through to the rules, which kind of list specific ones.
Is that what you normally do? Do you normally read down the objectives and policies by reading the zone purpose? Or read or expand upon them?
I think there's different opinions on that. But that's generally how I would interpret plans, is the zone purpose of the zone and then a different objective policies, and that should flow through into the rules.
So my question would a less restrictive activity status, such as discretionary, for example, meet that policy better than non-complying activity status?
Yes, I think you're right. I think the problem comes in with the broad definition of community activities.
But that's what the policy says.
Yeah.
It doesn't say community centres and halls and art galleries and daycare centres.
I agree.
Okay. Right. So my last question is, this is council-owned land, isn't it, this 101 Valentine Road? Does council own it all?
As far as I'm aware, yes.
So, what do you think about the position of the council as owner of land, being able to decide what zone it gives to its land? Is there anything to that? I suppose it doesn't have any more right than anyone else who says
I yes,
house,
I think that's why the whole process
that's
why the whole process is there for. People can submit on it. But it also offers opportunity to provide for things that
but
wouldn't initially be provided.
But only councils can provide.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So
Can I just follow, there was something I was going to ask Ms Scott really, because I mean again I don't know what, and I know you're here representing the council in its regulatory capacity, but I suppose the question was whether the council operating through its land ownership has either put in further submissions or don't, but
has.
Hasn't in this case, I don't think.
It has in other situations, but not
here.
Mr. Munro.
No thanks.
Mr. Smith.
Thank you. Just to expand on that, I just do wonder if we're to have a large piece of council-owned reserve in here, is it foreseeable that around the perimeter or in the corner of that there might be community activities like a youth club building or a birthing hub in this case. I'm just trying to, you know, it is a reasonably big piece of land, albeit there's a significant demand for sports fields. I'm just not sure why other community uses might not be helpful in conjunction with that. And if we're to do that, I'm just running through the table in the open space rules, and there are things. A restaurant, for instance, on active recreation zone is a restricted discretionary activity or a controlled activity, depending on its location. You can do a number of different activities. Childcare, you can have a daycare facility as a discretionary activity. You can even have an art gallery or a cultural centre. So, keeping those types of activities in mind, how different is a birthing hub or a youth centre? And does it warrant elevating its status at least to a restricted discretionary or something like that to provide for other community uses? Given I do believe that is there scope to do that? You've said that the submission seeks that we actually amend that chapter to permit that activity. So
I definitely see a merit in that. I think the issue is, and why it probably hasn't been identified, is that it could have whatever sensitivity with, I mean, you wouldn't necessarily want a birthing unit next to a stadium. So, I don't know if it's, or prison.
Would a restricted discretionary status where you are able to consider those reverse sensitivity issues address that concern? If there is a range of concerns that are specific to an activity that you could consider, would you not be able to cover those off in a rule?
Potentially, if you can list all the matters that you think is relevant, yes.
Okay.
So could a non-complying makes you consider the scale of whatever they're proposing easier than what if you don't list the correct matters of discretion, or you could. That's the issue of listing every activity that under the definition of community activities.
Even a fully discretionary activity then that doesn't limit your
potentially.
I'm just trying to explore whether we can pull it out of that non-complying status, because that's saying non-complying implies that it is, you know, there isn't. Well, in most cases it's not suitable, whereas I think we're saying in some cases it might be suitable, and maybe the different status might reflect that.
Yeah, I see your argument.
I wonder if you might give some thought to how, if we were minded to do that, if we were minded to allow for that activity and potentially other community activities to be allowed for in that zone, how might we be best do that in the rules for that zone?
I think the main thing for me, the main argument is that the activities that's considered and anticipated in the zones already identified. We start going and identifying different, for each zone, make a list of all the activities, it's starting to trying to cover everything. I think the way that this chapter is structured is to try and identify things that fits in different open space and recreational zones. So it's I'm a bit concerned that it's going to get a bit problematic if you start to try to make exceptions for every submittal zone specific rules for specific community activities.
That table already does that.
Yeah, I mean, it
does
it.
Like
every
just a jolly thing under the sun.
As I said, you can have a restaurant there. You can you can have a restaurant or an art gallery or I mean, I think there is similarities between those activities, and clearly you need to have opportunity to assess the location and the suitability of the specific activity. But I have some sympathy to being able to do that. You know. As I said, there might be a youth club or a, you know, it's already allows for childcare facilities. We have restaurants. We have that might be attached to a football club, for instance, presumably.
Planting of a new forest.
Yeah, forestry is discretionary.
Forestry.
Carbon credits.
So anyway, I mean, I think. You know, I think there's something we can work through there. I only have one other question. How far did you go into the hail stuff in terms of the cost or the work required to contain the hazardous materials? And equally, have you done any? Was there any investigation done into the cost of, I suppose, rehabilitating that site to the stage of having a sports field on it?
I think the Section 32 briefly looked at it. I've got some consenting experience with contaminated sites and specifically wastewater sites where it's basically mostly biological things. So the NES for contaminated soils basically is a pathway to address that, and one thing though that makes it more desirable to put sport fields there is that you wouldn't necessarily have to compact it to be able to take buildings when you potentially cap or remove the soil and put new soil in, which makes it a bit more desirable for sport fields.
Okay, one other really super brief question. If you didn't think that those community activities were suitable on in the active recreation zone, is there another zone that sits within that chapter, specifically civic spaces zone or community purpose zone, that might allow for that activity on part of that site? And is there scope to do that, or is it only scope to change that zone to allow for this activity?
I'm not sure on the scope.
Excuse me. The scope for an alternative zone would need to be somewhere between active sports and recreation and general industrial. I'm not familiar enough with the zones to tell you what.
I think it'd be fair to say that a community purpose zone would fit in that space, but yeah.
You'd have to just take a bit of care in terms of what's provided for.
In the active sport and recreation zones, in its purpose sense, it's to be used for blah blah blah,
in
community activities.
Yeah,
I mean, it's right
mm.
there.
I think you know, yeah, and I think we canvassed that in that. I think that there, we might want to look at the ability to provide for that zone in some level of status beyond non-complying in that zone. But equally, if there's an alternate, I'm open to that as well.
Thank you, Commissioner. I have a question that flows on from that. This is council land. Council's going to decide what its land is used for. Is the reality that the only RMA issues that need to be assessed are the effects on the neighbours?
Yeah, Yeah, and the best use of the site.
But the council will make its own decision about that. It's sort of the council.
They could also sell it.
Well,
easy target.
Also, it was council owned through the designation of Public Works Act, so if they did want to sell it, it would revert to the original owner. So, the question is, why would you do that?
Yeah.
Easy target.
Thank you, Mr. Bethy.
Equally, applying a reserve status, albeit through the district plan, would provide a greater degree of protection for that land from sale, not less. So.
Thank you. Ms. Scott, it's 2 minutes to five by my watch. Sorry, I think we'll call it a day. And what have you got planned for us tomorrow?
That's a good question, and we should just make sure we're clear. We did have Mr. Charles arrange to join us via Zoom at 9 a.m. We've just asked him to defer that until we've got through the general industrial zone evidence. He's available all day, so we will arrange a new arrangement for that. So I think first up we'll call Mr. Place. He has prepared evidence which is specific on text matters. We'll hear from him first. And then what I was proposing was to do the panel arrangement like we did during the other rezoning hearings. So essentially we'll just have everyone up here the whole time and go through each site, and you can ask questions of the witnesses. That worked really well in the previous hearings, which is why I proposed it. But we'll have everyone set up and ready to go, and we will direct traffic in terms of who's provided evidence on a particular site, and we'll follow the order of the Section 42A in terms of the way they address the rezoning submissions.
All good.
So I hope that helps. I do have one answer for you, and that is your question about the Coneburn industrial zone and whether they asked for a UGB. The decision very carefully refers to another submission as providing scope to put a UGB around that new zone. It was the Woodlot property submission, 501, but the report specifically says the scope for that UGB comes from elsewhere.
Okay, so it's not a precedent.
It's not.
Understand. Thank you very much.
Thank you. 9 o'clock. All right.
We are moving tomorrow. So ask Kat to give us a briefing on what's going on.